Welcome back. In this episode of Shadows from the Tree, we delve into the darker side of genealogy by exploring stories pulled from newspaper archives and using historical records to find the truth behind them. Specifically, this episode focuses on the theme of a shadow from our own family tree and the impacts it had on the lives of those involved. Join us as we shed light on those often overlooked stories and gain a deeper understanding of the challenges those involved faced. Listener discretion is advised and content is not appropriate for children. So, Michelle, here we are. We've been waiting for this.
This is the one that started it all. It drew us in and wanted us, you know, I just was totally motivated to find out more and more and more about this whole story.
Yes, and we're now ready to share it with you. So we did do an episode 10.1, which just gave some background on two members of our family that we are involved in this story. And now we're going to get to the event that took place. So if you did not listen yet, I do encourage you to go to 10.1 to listen. But a quick recap there, where we last left off was we had in 1870 in Gloucester, Rhode Island, we had William Ide, my third great grandfather, living with his three children. His wife had passed of childbirth complications, and Jeanette Davis Putnam was living with Ide as a housekeeper and had her own child at that time who was 2 months old. And they had been living right next to Jeanette's mother and her siblings at the time. So a couple of little things I just want to point out before we get into the story of like a timing perspective. So we had talked about before the land of William's father, Oliver, and had been passed down to his wife, Penelope, and then to his two other sons who ended up passing away. So Penelope ends up dying July 13th, 1873 at the age of 69. And so with no one else in the will, it goes in July 1875. We found documents in the town hall of the deed, and George and William, the two brothers, did purchase or get a mortgage out for the father's land. So they become now owners of this land in Foster, and it's described to be like 50 plus acres with buildings specifically quoted to be the mill lot. And it was just interesting how they listed the land, like there was no coordinates or, you know, directions. It was like north of Stephen Tucker, right of Peleg Angel. Like, yep. It was just, you know, it was just interesting how that was written. So with that, the mother dying and them going over to Foster, that is the next census that we find. And in June 1st of 1875, we are seeing William in Foster living in the town of Hopkins Mill. And I'm just going to read you quickly how it's shown in the census. And I love the census. Oh, it just gives such great information.
Yep.
So we have William Ide listed as 48. He's the head of the house, born in Foster, and listed as a carpenter. Then we have Jeanette Ide. With a common theme we've seen throughout the story with a different spelling. So,
different name every time.
So she's listed there, 23 years old, and it actually is listed here as his wife. And again, she's born in Connecticut, so she's a housekeeper. Then we have the children. We have Emily Ide at 8. We have Mary Ide at 7. Oh, I forgot James here. James, my second great-grandfather, he's 10. Then we have Laura Ide, 5, and William Ide, 3. And this is the first time we see extra children after his first wife died listed here as his daughter and son.
Right.
Which then make it seem we had lots of questions. Are they Jeanette's kid? You know.
Yeah.
We went through a rabbit hole there. But they are all born in Gloucester, and they're just listed as scholar on the census. So that's where they are in 1875. So then we start getting some background information from some newspaper articles like we do in all the other podcast episodes that we've done in the past. This one specifically had two really big articles from The Manufacturer and Farmers and The Providence Press from 1878, which we've seen that one a lot. And I've never heard of The Manufacturer's one before.
No, it must have gone out of print way before our time. But it was a local paper for Rhode Island.
Yeah, so that one, that gave really good information. So throughout the story, we're going to be quoting and pulling information from those just to give some detail. So they're living in Foster, okay? Their house was described in one of the newspaper articles. And I'm going to read it here just to, it really sets the scene. It says, "The house is an old-fashioned story and a half structure and wears a dilapidated and deserted aspect. It is unpainted and weather-beaten, and the surroundings add to the general loneliness and wildness of the spot. There's a sort of swamp between the buildings and the road, surrounded with small birch trees, and to the north are the remains of an old orchard long neglected and unfruitful. The interior of the house is as plain and unattractive as the exterior. There are four rooms on the ground floor, small and scantily furnished. The furniture consists mostly of rough chairs and stools, and the walls dirty and unpainted. There are three bedrooms, one at the northwest corner, which is then said to be William Ide's room, running out of the spare room, and two issuing from the kitchen. William's bedroom is said to be 8 by 6 feet in size, partially papered, and the floor strewn in with waste paper and deposits of all kind. A full-length picture of William Ide suspended from a nail, the only ornament to be seen." And I wish we had this picture!
Me too.
I want to know so much what he looked like. And to know that the only thing in this terrible house is a picture of himself.
Hanging on the wall.
It's just,
I wonder who commissioned that and like what the story was.
Yeah.
Why they had a really huge...
I mean, if the house was that bad, I'm sure whoever over time bought the next property just demolished the whole thing. But man, I wish we had that painting. But like, what was your first reaction when you read this specifically about the house?
It's a disaster. Like, what's going on? Like, you know, it can't be a happy, healthy home if it's looking like that kind
of... And there's children living here.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's crazy. So, I mean, no one should be living in conditions like that, first of all.
Right.
And, you know, the Ides, Oliver and Penelope, had lived there once before them. So, they just probably never did anything to keep up with it or fix it. Although he's a carpenter. So, I don't know.
There's, you know, some other things going on.
Yeah. Oh, yes, you are right. So that was about the house. The newspaper article also gives us something that we can't get due to the time period, which we were just talked about with pictures.
Right.
They give us description of their appearance and characteristics, which I think was huge in being able to get an understanding more of who they were and exactly what they looked like. So Jeanette, she's a blonde with light blue eyes and a profusion of curling light hair. She's about medium height, finely formed, and has an intelligent, ladylike expression. The neighbors speak very highly of her, and she has a gentle disposition and a cultured look. It was common talk how so handsome and intelligent a woman could live with such a man.
Yep.
So let's get to William, and you will totally understand why. So William, my third-great-grandfather, shamefully, he's a man of various pursuits, at times devoting his attention to farming, hunting, and fishing, and working at his trade as carpenter. He is 6 feet in height, black hair with a beard, broad-shouldered and muscular, and has a stern, forbidding countenance. According to residents of the village, he has an unsavory reputation in the neighborhood as a man of an ugly and quarrelsome disposition, and in company with his dog was the terror of Foster and the vicinity. His neighbors had every cause to dread his presence, and his dog killed their sheep without the owner thereof daring to mention the subject to him. When not under the influence of liquor, he was said to be an agreeable companion, but he drank very frequently and was savage and brutal, flourishing his loaded pistol with reckless fury when aroused, threatening to take the lift of any that dared to question his right to do as he pleased.
Sounds scary.
Yep. I mean, the fact that not only is he whipping around his pistol and threatening people, he's also said to be very muscular. Like, that would be very...
Yeah, he's a big guy. And yeah. She's this tiny, you know, tiny she girl, seems yeah. sweet
tiny
and
half
quiet
his age
and,
girl. Yeah. Could be yeah. his daughter.
Yeah. Less than, yeah.
So as you can see here, if the neighbors are threatened by him,
right.
how would it be to live in that house with him? Like, and this is where we get into domestic troubles.
Yeah, not even the men want to stand up to him because yeah. he's, like, off the rails.
Right. So, and just to give a background before I give some details that were pulled from the newspaper around the domestic troubles. So, here in Rhode Island, the first domestic violence law wasn't put out until 1979. So, we're talking 101 years later. And the first law they had passed was the Domestic Abuse Prevention Act, which was providing legal remedies for victims of domestic violence and establishing procedures for obtaining protective orders against abusers. So we're talking 101 years. There was no yeah. chance for her.
There's no laws to help her. Like,
yeah.
There's no one to call. There's nothing. Like,
yeah. And again, you're talking about children being in the home and...
And she literally had nowhere else to go. Like, right. seems like her mother handed her off to
right.
this
long
opportunity.
Ago,
13 yeah.
years.
Yeah.
13 years. Yeah.
So.
So, okay. So, in the newspaper, it was reported that, and this, I don't know if we can fact check, but one person in the newspaper had said that Jeanette came to live at the house of William Ide, which was originally in Gloucester, during the life of his wife. And after her death, remained there in consequence of the threats made against her if she went.
Yeah.
So this was news to us. Like,
yeah.
we thought she had just moved in after
mm-hmm.
the mom had
like,
the wife
help
had
with
died.
The house duties and helping with the care for the children. And
right, but it sounded like she was there before. Maybe
there
that month
left.
When she
yeah.
was ill, the wife was first wife was ill. So it was news to us, yeah, for sure that. She had been living there when Mary, William's
yeah.
first wife, was there.
Yeah, there wasn't a census that specific
no.
year, so.
And I wonder if, like, she saw how William treated Mary. I wonder if it was the same, or if he only got so bitter after
Maybe.
After the fact. So, but we can just say, from the very start, she felt threatened.
Mm-hmm.
So... This comes right from the newspaper. Difficulties between Ide and his mistress were common occurrences, and beatings were not of any alarming nature to the neighbors. They occurred so often, Ide was a terribly cruel man to his children, beating them at the slightest provocation. He drove his only legitimate son from the house, and soon we would find out what happened to the rest of the children. Many a night, when Ide was drunk, a common occurrence was Jeanette taking the little ones from bed and rushing to the neighbors for protection. At one time, she jumped through the window with both in her arms. Like that, when we read that...
Yeah. It just paints the worst kind of picture, really.
Right, and as a mom, like, thinking about trying to
yeah,
just take your kids...
the desperation.
Yes, that's exactly the word.
Yeah.
Desperation.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. It's just, it gives me shivers, actually.
Yep.
So.
He must have been a terrifying, disturbed person.
Yeah. And yeah. even though he's my third great grandfather,
yeah.
my empathy goes for Jeanette fully. Like,
yeah.
fully.
Right.
Like, and to know.
It was his drinking. Like,
right.
they said, he was a decent enough person when he wasn't.
Right. But he just drank all the time.
yeah.
So.
Yeah.
There was no hope. Yeah. So, you know, obviously there was a lot going on from the domestic standpoint, and she had been dealing with this since at least 1868 when the first wife died.
Yeah.
So
10 years of this. For
yeah. Me. Yeah. So I'm going to pass it over to Michelle. So she's going to kind of give a breakdown and start the tale of
the events.
The events that occurred. So Michelle, I'll hand it over to you.
To Warwick would be what, half an hour?
Yep.
6 hours by
by horse.
Okay. Yep. And Green Island is a small island in Narragansett Bay, and after years a piece may only be seen at low tide.
Yeah, so now it's like barely yep. in existence.
Yeah, erosion and the sea levels are just mm-hmm. it's gone.
Because I heard Green Island, I didn't even know where yeah. that was. I had to look it up.
It's like not a touristy location
no.
that we go to.
No.
Oh, man. So a week later, Thursday, March 21st, 1878, he returned home about midnight with 3 or 4 bushels of nice clams. And his brother, George, stated that he was drunk. Are we surprised?
No.
You wonder how he got home, though, that late at night.
I know. And then you wonder the landscape of the land, right? Like, they didn't have highways, turn left, turn right. Did he have a straight chute there?
Yeah. But I had horses growing up, so they kind of know their way home, really.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, so I feel like maybe the horse led the
way. And then the horse is carrying all these bushels, right, or this wagging something. Yep. And then, so I had to Google how many clams are in a bushel, because I don't know.
Yeah, how many, Danielle?
There's a range, 200 to 600, depending on the size of the clam or the type of clam or the region. But still, he's got
a lot of clams, yeah.
He's got almost 1,000 clams he's bringing back with him. Wouldn't he be happy? And I don't know.
Maybe he was happy. Then
he drank the drink.
celebrating on the way home. All right. So back at the house when he arrived, so he was there. Jeanette, 25. His brother George, which he's 59, and 4 children. So William, 6. Laura, 8. Mary, 10. Emily, 11. And James wasn't there?
Yeah, James wasn't recorded. And I think from the past article, by that time he was old enough and he left. Yeah. He was like, I'm out of here.
Which he's
my second great grandfather. So this could have been a pivotal moment for him growing up to make a better life for himself, you know?
He wasn't there in this situation.
Right.
So it was for the best for him.
Yeah.
Upon arriving home, he still had been drinking, and William asked George to assist him with unharnessing the horse and unloading the clams, and George did so. William then went into the house, and in a few moments, Mrs. Putnam, which is Jeanette, ran out greatly excited, declaring that William had threatened to shoot her, and she did not dare to return. He had been quarreling with her, and George went into the house and asked his brother if he had made threats to kill Jeanine. He denied it and that he had any intentions of harming her, and George persuaded Jeanette to return to the house. After the entrance of the housekeeper, William returned and resumed the quarrel, accusing her of receiving letters from her mother, and in blind jealousy, believing that she had been persuading her daughter to leave him.
Yeah, because she...
Right.
It's about jealousy of him, her being with other men, but who is she gonna... It's a little town.
I don't know. The neighbors are all older. Like Stephen Tucker, how old he was?
Yeah.
Way older than
William. Yeah, he was like William. Yeah, exactly. So that doesn't make sense. But if he's drunk.
Yeah, he's just throwing out accusations.
Exactly.
And he found the letter, so he was probably scared he was going to lose whoever was barely maintaining keeping the house together, right?
Yeah.
So. By some means, they met in the bedroom, and William seized his mistress in a savage grasp, and they clinched each other. Before his brother could do any serious injury, George came to the rescue and separated them. Mrs. Putnam, which the articles keep referring to
I don't know why she kept that name.
I don't know. And hastened from the house, and with the intention of taking refuge in the house of Mr. Stephen Tucker across the road, she passed through an orchard. But before she could cross the road, William had overtaken her. This is where it gets.
And we're really reading from this because it honestly, I get goosebumps. Yeah, I really do. You can feel what this poor woman went through.
You feel the energy. You feel the despair. And the,
oh, gosh. Yeah.
He seized her by the hair and literally dragged her across the rough ground with stones to the house. The neighbors oversaw and they heard her screams and cries for help as she struggled in the grasp of the irate master. William kicked her and jumped upon her before they reached the house. After they entered the house, George persuaded them to give up quarreling, and they seemed to be on good terms when he left them.
I just shake my head. It's...
Like, my voice was shaking me.
Yeah.
It's just, like, so scary and sad and...
And I've never, luckily, had any kind of domestic tragedy in my life. And I just, I feel, for anyone who's out there listening that's had to experience that. And,
So now we are, it was late enough, right?
Right.
And the neighbors were still able to hear that. But now, between 3 and 4 a.m., while laying on the floor, William... Taking a pistol from a drawer, he pointed it at an almost senseless woman, and he should shoot her. Before going to the bedroom to lay down on the bed, he soon fell asleep. And over the bedroom door hung a double-barreled shotgun. The mangled and bruised woman on the floor saw it. She knew one barrel was loaded with a heavy charge of a shot for fox hunting. She had a weapon. Her torturer was asleep in the other room. She might save her life by taking his. Her wounds added fire to her thoughts. Her fears were fuel. Revenge was an object. Crawling along the floor, she rose by an extreme effort and secured the gun. Crawling along the floor, she reached the bed, rose, and placed the muzzle against the brow of the sleeping man, pulling the trigger and falling to the floor.
I know.
Yeah. So, same time. So George was awakened between the hours of 3 and 4 by the loud report of a gun. He saw Janine standing in the door of the bedroom. She said very calmly, "If you want to lay your brother out, you can get the neighbors to do it." He died without a struggle. The brother was thoroughly stupefied for a few moments, but managed to dress himself and hasten to the house of Stephen Tucker and Pele Angel nearby and returned with them to the bed of the body of William. They entered the bedroom to a terrible spectacle. His hand had been partially raised towards his head and his face blackened with powder. A large hole in the center of his forehead showed that the shots had penetrated the brain and skull, and upon turning his head, there was the cavity large enough to allow the insertion of a man's fist. The bed clothing and wall were bespattered with blood and brains, and the floor was sprinkled with gore. The neighbors removed the clothing, and after sewing up the head in a bag, they might be held together. They placed the remains upon a rude board and covered him with a sheet. Jeanette remained quietly in the house, making no effort to escape, and lie down upon her bed, suffering intensely from the bruises and blows received by being dragged through the orchard.
Oh my gosh. I know. Oh my gosh. When you read this, it's like the description. I was not expecting, when we first were told by my aunt who found this, like, I was not expecting to read this.
No. I remember when
my jaw dropped.
Like, there was a printout, right?
And yeah.
We were at a family gathering, and it was getting passed around, and I was like, this is, like, what, pages and pages? It's like, this is about our family? Like, this is someone in our family. I couldn't even believe it.
But you have to think, like, being in the newspaper, no one, I guess they had to write the detailed if you wanted to get the scene, but, and there's Jeanette.
Yeah.
Just trying to lay down and, yeah. So, how are we going to leave it, Michelle?
Yep. Soon the village would be thrown into unusual excitement, as it was the first murder on record in the town. The news spread like wildfire, and careful investigations and inquiries had disclosed details of a deliberate yet aggravated homicide. I would say it was...
It's pretty clear.
Yeah. Self-defense more than anything, I would say.
Yeah. We're going to leave it there. Because there is more to the story following what happened.
Yeah.
And it's a lot to process. It's a lot of process. So we definitely are going to give a recap and give some more details, even including a little bit of our experience researching into this and visiting what we thought is the road. The road, Tucker the nearby Hollow. Road.
Yep. Just everything about it was eerie and left the hair standing on your arms. And it was just really creepy. The whole time was creepy.
Yeah.
But this story is really, I don't know, it's really hit me. I feel like it's also, you know.
Oh, yeah. It's being in my family, to think this was somebody in my, like, my family. It's crazy. Not expected, which is why, truly, everyone out there, there are shadows in your family tree. It's just, if you want to and dig around, you just gotta find it. But it was a wild time back then, so.
Right. And like you said, there were no laws to protect her.
Mm-hmm.
Even the neighbors didn't even want to bring up anything against him because he was terrifying.
So scary.
And they were, you know, we're going to talk about what happens after the days following what her fate is. Even her daughter was sick.
Yeah.
We didn't mention that, but she had a sick daughter in the next room.
While this is all happening. Yeah. So, it's a lot to uncover. So, we hope you enjoyed the episode and
Tune in next time.
Tune in next time.
For the wrap up.
Yep.
For season one.
And thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. If you do have questions, yep, feel free to email us shadowsfromthetree@gmail.com.
Yeah. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Bye.